All right, this is read the Sedra of Shmos, beginning the second Chumash of the Torah. At the end of the second parak, actually middle of the second parak, Moshe Rabbeinu was forced to flee Egypt as a fugitive. He was wanted by Paro for murder, killed the Egyptian, Vayifan Kovacho, Vayakeinish, Vayachat Hamitzri, Vayapaneo Bacho. He looked back and forth, saw no one was there, killed a Mitzri who was beating a Jew. And then when the word got out, so Moshe Rabbeinu was forced to flee. In any event, Paro had already recognized from earlier in the Sedra, where it says, Vayigdal Moshe Vayetzei Lechov, Moshe Rabbeinu came of age, Bar Mitzvah actually, and he went out to see what was happening to his fellow Jews. So Paro realized that he was a destabilizing force in society. So Moshe Rabbeinu leaves, he's 18 years old, comes back, at the end of our Sedra, and Vayera says he stood before Paro with Aaron, and Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old. John, 62 years. Where was he all this time? The Medrash says, the famous Medrash, that Moshe Rabbeinu first fled Paro, went to the land of Cush. Whatever Cush is, Ethiopia, in Sinai, in Arabia, we don't really know. But after 9 years there, king died, and the people so impressed with Moshe's wisdom and stature that they made him a king. So he was the king of Cush for 40 years until, I guess then he's in his late 60s. And from Cush, he went to Midian. And that's where our story starts today. Perek Vez Pasuk Tesvav. Vayishma Paro es hadavar hazeh. Paro heard what Moshe had done. Vayvekesh larogus Moshe. And he endeavored to kill Moshe. Vayevrach Moshe mipnei Paro. Moshe fled. Vayeshev beretz Midyon. Vayeshev al haba'er. Moshe Rabbeinu then dwells in the land of Midyon. Vayeshev al haba'er. He goes and sits near the well. You'll just notice in the pasuk from Vayevrach Moshe mipnei Paro. Vayeshev beretz Midyon. Between those sets of three words, almost 50 years passes. Those 50 years are not really part of the Torah story. It's just narrative, biographical data of Moshe's life, but it plays no role really in what the Torah is trying to teach us. In any event, he goes to Midyan. Right away he goes to the Be'er, and Chazal say, just like the Avos did, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, good things always happen at Be'er. Be'er, of course, was also the town square where people gathered, because that's where they derived their nourishment, their sustenance, and it was a hangout. That's where Moshe knew that he would meet the elders, the leaders of the town. Ula Kohen Midyan Sheva Banos. The Kohen of Midyan is not identified here, Yisro, has seven daughters. Vatavona Vatidlena. And they came, and they came in order to fill their fill the channels, fill their pails, and take water in order to give water, quench the thirst of their father's flock. But the shepherds came, drove them away. Moshe arose and saved them. Hero. Vayashkes sonom, and he gave their sheep water to drink. Vatavona el Reuel Avihen, they came to Reuel their father. Vayomer, and he said, Madu amiarten boayom, what took you so long today? Vatamarna, they said, Ish Mitzri, Tzilon amiyad aroim, Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian man, saved us from the shepherds. In any event, we'll see that Yisra had fallen on the outs with the people of Midyan, but no doubt that as the first recorded case in Torah, sexual harassment, I would imagine every day his daughters came, you know, and his sons, his daughters came to get water, and the male shepherds drove them away. And this time didn't happen, so Yisro was curious. And they said, a Mitzri, an Egyptian saved us, Vigam dolo dololonu vayashkes atzon, he also drew the water for us, gave it to the flock. Vayomer el ben Osov, he said to his daughters, Vayo, where is he now? By the way, you see Chazal say, the sensitivity of the Torah, Moshe was criticized. because they said in his presence, Ish Mitzri, he tzilonu miyad aroyim. An Egyptian saved us, and Moshe didn't say anything. As opposed to Yosef, who even in the dungeon at Egypt said to the Sarah Mashim Sarofim, Kigunov Gonafti Meretz Ovrim, I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, meaning I'm an Ivri. Moshe let that pass quietly, without protest, that he was a Mitzri. So Chazal say because of that, Yosef was Zocha to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, and Moshe not. How sensitive the Torah is to every nuance. So Yisro says, where is this man who saved you? Lomo zeh azavten esoish. Why did you abandon him? Kiren lo, v'yocha lechem. Come in, we'll give him some bread. Now, the Medrash fills in some of the gaps of this story also. We have to understand who was Yisro. And I want to really look at today the relationship of Moshe and Yisro. Who was Yisro? Yeah. Moshe is probably around this time, close to 70 years old. Yeah, doesn't mean Tzipora is 10 years old. She could have been 20, 30 years old. Good match. Wealthy father, that's the thing. Oh. So who was Yisro? So Medrash says that Yisro, as the Gemara in Sotah, Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, Yisro was one of Paro's three advisors. And Paro asked them what to do with the Jews. Three advisors were Eov, Yisro, and Bilam. Bilam said to enslave them, and Bilam remained Paro's advisor. Eov was silent, and so the Gemara says he was punished with the series of punishments that he had. Yisro fled. Because Yisro, it's a little complicated, but Yisro knew that whatever answer he would give would not be good. He favored the Jews, said don't enslave them, it's like he's disrespecting Paro. He said enslave the Jews, then it's not just. So Yisro fled. Yisro fled, and he came to Midian. When he came to Midian, he was there for many years, but being who he was, he recognized Moshe as a fugitive, and immediately he panicked, and he threw Moshe in a pit. And Moshe spent 10 years in that pit, fed secretly every day by his daughter Tzipora. Eventually, Yisro warmed to Moshe. Very often a prospective father-in-law wants to throw the prospective son-in-law in the pit as soon as he meets him. But over time, Yisro warmed to Moshe as well and then brought him out of the pit. And then the next pasuk happened where the Torah says, Vayah Moshe lo sheves esa'ish. Moshe persisted in staying there, didn't leave, went to work for Yisro. Vayitena tziporo vitola Moshe. And he gave Tzipora, his daughter, to Moshe. Now, Yisro was Kohen Midyan. If you look at Rashi here, Rashi says in Pasuk Tezayin that he was Kohen Midyan, he was Rav Shebohen, he was the leading priest, the high priest of Midyan, until that day. Uperash Shlom Evodes Elilim. At that day he renounced his paganism, his idolatry, v'niduhu me'etzlam. And the society, so disenchanted with their priests renouncing his religion, that they excommunicated him. And that was Yisro. Now Yisro was something else also. We know this from Parshas Yisro, where Rashi goes into a little more biographical data about Yisro's life. It's Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Aleph. You notice he's still called Kohen Midyan in our Sedra and then in Yisro as well, even though he'd renounced it. Nonetheless, Rashi says that Yisro Sheva Shemos Nikrulo, he had seven names, because even here it says Reuel Avihen. Names Reuel, Yeser, Yisro, Chovov, Chever, Kaini, Putiel, those are all his names. Yisro was the name by which he was most known. Whenever someone has multiple names, it means they're a multidimensional figure. And there are many aspects of that person's personality. They're very unique, very creative, hard to pigeonhole or categorize simply. And that really was Yisro. Rashi goes on to say, explains all the names. Rashi goes on to say that Yisro was noted for, it was Pasuk Yud Aleph. When Yisro says, Atah Yodati, Ki Gadol Hashem Mikol Olahim, now I know that you are greater than any of the other powers in the world because of what happened in Yetzias Mitzrayim. So how does he know? So Rashi says, really identifying the personality of Yisro for us, Rashi says that that Yisro recognized every Avodah Zarah in the world, every idolatry. He did not leave even one idolatry unworshipped, meaning he explored every religion of the world. Yisro was a spiritual dilettante, like a professor of comparative religions. He sampled everything. So he knew now, based on what had happened to the Jewish people, and based on his knowledge, Ki Gadol Hashem Mikol Elohim, that God is greater than all the other gods in the world. And of course, Mashmu Ashama Uva, why did he eventually come back and join Moshe? Because of the variety of experiences of Yetzias Mitzrayim that he heard. So now he knew that Hashem Hu Elohim, God was God. But Yisro's personality really was to seek out. He was a searcher. He was always trying to find himself and looking for new experiences. I think, if you ask me, that's why he was called Yisro. Of the seven names that he had, he was most known as Yisro. What's Yisro? Like Yosef, something extra. He's always looking for something extra. Something that he doesn't have. Something different. Something more than he already has. So this day, interestingly enough, that Moshe arrived in Midian, was the day that Yisro had renounced his paganism, hadn't yet embraced the new faith, but he had at least understood intellectually that what he had been propagandizing all those years was false, and the society rejected him. I once flew on a little plane from, I think it was from Cincinnati to... Indianapolis, Cincinnati. I think that's what it was. Very small, a 20-seater. And I sat next to a minister who had a very, very interesting life story. And among things that he told me is that he had been a Protestant minister, very large congregation in Washington, and then he just decided that it was false and Catholicism was true. And he got up one Sunday morning and he gave a clop, whatever the word for clop is, and he said, I don't believe this anymore. I believe in Catholicism. And actually, he was in Pennsylvania. That's where he was. And he became a lay Catholic minister because he was married. And now he teaches at Catholic University in Washington. But he got up Sunday morning and just said, I don't believe this anymore. And what did they do? They treated him exactly how they treated Yisro in Midian. They excommunicated him. They said, okay, you can leave by the end of the day, because they weren't about to join him on his odyssey. So that's what happened to Yisro, which makes it all the more puzzling, all the more curious, that when Yisro begins his relationship with Moshe Rabbeinu, it happens in a very strange way. This the Yalkut records, and the Baal HaTurim mentions it here on the Sedra, Ulechohein Midyan. So the Baal HaTurim writes that Yisro hayakomer lavodas elilim. Yisro was an idolatrous priest. Kishenosa Moshe Bito, when Moshe wanted to marry his daughter Tzipora, Hutzrach Moshe Lindorlo, he forced Moshe to take a vow, Sheben Arishon Sheyivoledlo, the first child, the first son that Moshe and Tzipora would have, that Bechor would become Levodas Elilim. He would become an idolatrous priest, just like his grandfather was. And Moshe agreed. Moshe agreed. V'zeh kavanoso. Moshe's intention was, ki yada sheyachazir es chomov l'muto. He knew that he would eventually be able to persuade his father-in-law of the truth and the beauty of the Das Avram. K'moshe also, as in fact happened by Yishma Yisro, bo sharein is gayer. Moshe Rabbeinu, in fact, was able to convert Yisrael. So Moshe's plan did work. Mikol Makom, nonetheless, Nenash. Moshe himself was nonetheless punished by even agreeing to the arrangement to begin with. Sheben Beno Naaseh Komer Lavodah Selilim. Moshe's grandson became an idolatrous priest, according to Sefer Shoftim, in Perek Yudches. His grandson, Yehonasan, the Yehonasan ben Gershom ben Menashe, the Navi says, was a priest to idolatry. If you look in the in Sefer Shoftim, the word Menashe is written with a very small nun, as if the nun should be deleted and it should be read Moshe. And Chazal say, Shmuel did this, Shmuel Anavi, when he wrote it, did this in order to preserve the dignity of Moshe Rabbeinu, to conceal an explicit reference to him as the grandfather of Yehonasan, his Komer Levodah Zarah, but by the same time, Anavi can't lie, it's Hanemar and Be'emes, so they wrote the name, that's how they wrote Menashe, and they couldn't lie, so they made a small nun to be able to know the truth as well. Eventually, by the way, this Yehonasan renounced idolatry also, and David HaMelech was able to bring him and his descendants and make them, I think they became the accountants of the in the Beis HaMikdash, or in his kingdom. But nonetheless, they were brought back. In any event, he's Moshe Rabbeinu's own grandson. And this, the Targum Yonasan says in our Sedra, this was the son, Gershom, that Moshe Rabbeinu failed to circumcise, because he had been given to his father-in-law to be raised. And so when Moshe Rabbeinu was returning in Perek Dalet to Mitzrayim after receiving his mission, so that was the one that Moshe Rabbeinu did not circumcise and nearly lost his life. Perek Dalet Pasuk Chof. Vaykach Moshe Eshtov Es Banov. They went back. One second. Oh, Pasuk Chof Hei. They came to an inn. God encountered them, sought to kill Moshe. Tzipor realized what had happened, but Tikach Tzipor at Tzor, but Tichars was her last benos, and she did the Milo on Gershom, but Tzagal threw it down. Vatomer ki chasan domim matali. So Targum Yonasan says that was why Moshe didn't give him a bris, because he was fulfilling his commitment to Yisro not to allow Yisro to have his first son be raised by Yisro in accordance with Yisro's religious doctrines. A stunning development, if we think about it. Of all people, Moshe Rabbeinu. He didn't have the last name Rabbeinu yet, but nonetheless, he was still the Gadol that Hashem recognized enough that in the very next pasuk, two pasukim later, he would reach out to Moshe to be Moshe on Shal Yisrael. So how is it possible that Moshe would agree to such a thing that would have such devastating consequences in Moshe's family? Very, very strange. And I'll tell you something that's just as strange. Maybe we can understand the old Yisro doing this, because he was an experimenter. He was an investigator. He was on a spiritual quest. But not the Yisro post-Moshe, because then he had renounced his paganism. He renounced his idolatry. Perash lo mevodah selilim. He left it. So if he left it, suffering the scorn and obloquy from his society because he did leave it, so why would he make such a bizarre request of Moshe? And by the way, Rashi says, that's why in this context, the vayavo horoim vayigashum, the shepherds came and drove away Yisro's daughters, Mifnei Hanidoi, because they were now in Chayram, the whole family. The whole family's in Chayram. They had defied the religious conventions of the day. They don't deserve our water, till Moshe came. Moshe came and rescued them. But if, in fact, Yisro left this idolatry, so why now then would Yisro demand such an odd thing from Moshe Rabbeinu for a religion or a religious lifestyle that he had just abandoned? And of course, why would Moshe agree? Granted, the Balaturim says, the Yalkut says, because Moshe knew that he'd eventually be able to convince Yisro, convert him, so that he wouldn't have to act upon it. But nonetheless, he really did, you see, to give his bris a son, which was the hallmark of the B'nai Avram. Moshe might have assumed as well that Yisro would free him of this oath once he saw the beauty of the Agus. But still, how do you agree to such a thing? You think back to the famous story of Rabbi Amnon of Mainz that we read in the Nesana Tokev, that the bishop of Mainz gave him 3 days or asked him to convert, and he said, give me 3 days. And right away, that's a story, that's a very moving and a sad story. That's tied to Yom Laron. Rabbi Amnon came back, didn't come back after 3 days. So he said to the king, when he was dragged out, cut off my tongue, because I never should have even asked for 3 days to renounce the Dasa Emes, Dasa Elohim Chai. And the king, the bishop said, no, you spoke well, all instead of cut off your legs. And in fact, cut off his legs, his arms, he became a quadruple amputee, and then he died just a short time later, right after he recited with the Nesana Tokev. But he himself criticized himself for waiting 3 days, for asking for 3 days, even if he knew that he would never do it. So Moshe Rabbeinu, how did he agree to such a thing? Very strange. How does Moshe Rabbeinu agree to let his first son, his Bechor, be raised by Avodah Zarah? Rav Dessler, the two pshatim I want to offer, both of which really are tied into the way we look at our world, and really we look at ourselves, and tremendous musa. Rav Dessler said that Moshe, with all good intentions that he had, was blinded firstly by his love of Tzipora. I would understand, we look at the Yalkut, she fed him for 10 years, if this was the condition, and he anticipated never having to fulfill, to carry through on his oath, to execute that commitment to Yisro, so you can understand that why he would do it. But that's like, that's romance. Rav Dessler really goes to the heart of the issue. Rav Dessler says that he spent time in Midian, and even Moshe Rabbeinu, on some small, infinitesimal level, was influenced by the environment. When one lives in an idolatrous environment, you accommodate yourself to it. It doesn't seem so bad after all. So Moshe Rabbeinu, now living in, first in Egypt, which was pagan, and then in Cush, and then in Midian, which was a pagan, idolatrous atmosphere, over time, very gradually, we begin to accustom ourselves to it. We accommodate ourselves. It doesn't seem so bad. You get used to it. That's the power of environment, of society, of culture. The more things seep into the mainstream dialogue of society, into our vernacular, into our hashkafas ha'olam, our worldview, the less problematic it seems. And we start adapting to everything. Everything doesn't bother us anymore. Whether it's, look at our world, it's called Shabbos, it's in the Jewish context. Adultery, homosexuality, immorality, lying, falsehoods. When it becomes a cornerstone of society, such that if you're intolerant of these things, there's something wrong with you. You're judgmental, you're not pluralistic, you're not understanding. Unless you are able to build some internal bulwark against these trends, then a person succumbs. And right away, doesn't seem that bad. Doesn't seem that bad. Better. Hold it. Rav Dess is focusing on Moshe. So I want to put two perspectives. Why Moshe did what he did, and why Yisro did what he did. It doesn't seem so bad anymore. I mean, we're basically in a Christian society. It's very interesting that I was reading, we don't look at it that way. But America is more of a Christian society in terms of numbers than Israel is a Jewish society. Israel, forget even Yesha, Israel has a 75% Jewish population, 25% are non-Jews. America is 95% Christian. 95% Christian. It's an overwhelmingly Christian society. And so the notion of a man-God doesn't bother us anymore. We used to. They seem like nice people. Very nice people. It doesn't bother us. And when the norms of society start encroaching on our lifestyle, in terms of premarital sex and morality and all the things that now seep into the Jewish world, like I mentioned on Shabbos, with reform, conservative, it doesn't seem so bad. You know, live and let live. You live and let live too long, and you can't live anymore, because the immorality becomes the norm. It becomes the foundation of the society. So it's looking like Sodom. That's what Sodom was. Sodom was such an inhospitable environment, Rom dechatom Hashem Ma'od, because they no longer had even the mechanism for identifying what's moral anymore. God, their entire moral compass was distorted, completely distorted. And now, in America, it's almost a similar thing. You can't even advocate any type of objective moral norm without looking like some type of reactionary, a self-serving Neanderthal who's probably a hypocrite too, and just a killjoy, and is coercive, and wants to ruin everyone else's life. And that's the perception that exists. That affected Rav Dessler, says Moshe Rabbeinu also. Didn't seem so bad. So you know what? He used to seem like a nice fellow. Tzipora, lovely young woman. So the offer, which is a future offer, speculative in any event, maybe his firstborn won't be his son. And maybe Yisrael will die. Who knows what will happen? He'll change his mind too. So why not? Nonetheless, that accommodation, the Yalkut says, Mikom Makom Nenash. Moshe Rabbeinu, because of that weakness, very subtle, so subtle that we might not be able to pick it up in ourselves, which we don't. Nenash, Sheben Beno, Naseh Kom Elavodah Selilim. Moshe Rabbeinu, who waged lifetime battle against idolatry, nonetheless, because of this one slip, maybe it wasn't that bad. Part of it seeped into Gershom, and invariably seeped into the way Gershom was raised as well. And Moshe paid a price for that. So now we can understand at least why Moshe did, as Rav Dessler said. Explains Moshe. What about Yisro? If Yisro this very day had renounced idolatry, looking to embrace some new faith, so why would he want his own grandson to make the same mistakes that he did? To do the same thing. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, Zatzal, the Rashiva of the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, said a very interesting shot. Yisro didn't want his grandson to repeat his mistakes. No grandparent wants that. You know, every parent will tell a child, a grandparent tell a grandchild, I did this, so you do it. Sometimes it's correct, sometimes not correct. You want them to live your life, what worked for you should work for them as well. I remember when we got married, so my parents said to us, go live in Pelham Parkway. That's where they live, where they live. And my in-laws said, no, go live in Stuyvesant Town. Because that's where they live, they're very happy. What does that do with us? But every parent says, it worked for us, it will work for you too. So we went to Queens instead, which I think all the children do. No one really listens to parents when they get married. He didn't want, his grandson to repeat his mistake. What he wanted him to do was to repeat his odyssey, his spiritual journey. That's what he was looking for. You walk in my footsteps, not that you'll take the same route necessarily, but intellectually, spiritually, you'll have the same journey that I did. I don't think so. Seven daughters. Right. Could very well be. What he wanted his grandson to have was free choice, not to have any religion imposed upon him, but rather he should come to the truth on his own. Now that's a very prevalent attitude in society today. You see it most in the children of mixed marriages, where the parents will say, and it's the norm in America today, we raise them with both religions, either none or both. Both religions, so all the holidays. When they get older, they'll make their own choice. You know, we don't want to tell them what to do. Or a parent will say, and this is also unfortunately very common in our world, you know, give the kid a Hebrew school education, child is bar mitzvah, bas mitzvah at the right age, and that's it, it ends. After that, if they want it, they'll seek it on their own. We'll impose it upon them, all right? The same parent who would not let a child go even one bedtime without brushing his teeth and insist the child eat his veggies till they're 30, 40 years old, when it comes to the most important area of life, a person's values, a person's religious commitment, there in that case, they say, no, that's free choice. That's up to the child, without really contemplating or fully educating the child about the ramifications of that choice, without even exposing them to the truth of Torah so that they'd be able to make an informed choice. And unfortunately, outside our world, that's really the norm. You know, the special events will be celebrated. The holidays, very nice. You have the Hanukkah here, you have the Noroh, you have the Seder. And those experiences, which from our context, from our perspective, are special events, not the norms of life. They're special events. Those experiences are the ones that are supposed to interest them, as if we're a religion of holidays, and the Targum Mitzvahs relate to holidays. See, very few of the Targum Mitzvahs relate to holidays. Most relate to the daily avodah, the daily service of the person. If you wanted to give a child the true experience of the others, I get up in the morning, go to school, get on tefillin, sit and learn part of the day, be honest in business, wear tzitzis, keep kosher. Those are daily things. Keep Shabbos. It's a weekly thing. That's Yadus. Not the menorah. Not the Seder. Those are things that are designed to reinforce certain ideas during the course of the year. Sukkah. Shofar. They're designed to strengthen, underscore certain disparate points about Yadus. But they're not the daily experiences that we have, but that they're not given. Because parents also, we live in, of course, a pluralistic society, and parents feel also what's more important is the quest, not the goal. That's how you serve it. It's important that he always be seeking, always be searching. Never give in. Never say, okay, this is it, I found what I wanted. Now, what underlies that notion as well is the sad reality that Yisro was articulating that he does not believe there's any objective truth. The truth is relative. If truth is relative, then what is important is the quest and not the destination. And that, in fact, was what Yisro's religious position now. Having renounced idolatry, it doesn't mean he became a misnagid. And was sitting in the Beis Medrash. He had nothing. He had no religion. He had experiences in all the religions. But it's only later on, after Yetzias Mitzrayim, by Yishma Yisro, Chohei Midyon, Eskol Asher Elokim Yisrael. Then he heard what happened. Then he embraced Yadus. In fact, HaMachlokes, the Gemara Zvachim, that Rashi cites part of, did he come before Matan Torah, did he come after Matan Torah? If he came before Matan Torah, the question then, the thought is that he came as a result of the historical experience of the Jewish people. A nation emerging, Goy Miker of Goy, one nation emerging, like an infant in childbirth from the midst of another nation, whole, complete, with a God who has a special destiny for them. Or did he come after Matan Torah, which means what drew him were the ideas of Yadus? Here the nation has a law, divine law, objective truth. That's what drew Yisro to the Jewish people. Whatever it is, at this point, he did not have it. And because he did not have it, he wanted his grandson to celebrate all holidays, all religions, learn exactly like I did, do the same thing that I did in the past, make your own choice. right? Like the parent says to the child, age 13, now you're on your own. Now you'll be able to study on your own what you want. Every other area of life, of course, you insist the child continue. High school, college, graduate school, except when it comes to your religious faith, your religious understanding. That already comes to you at age 19. Letting a child choose means either that there's no truth, and therefore what's the difference? What he chooses, Crest or Colgate, it's the same thing. It also means it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what he chooses, which is also a very prevalent ideology. Can you be a good person? Your relationship with God is whatever it is, it's up to you, we don't really care, because one's relationship with God really doesn't impact on your values or your ethical commitments. Why would we think it would? It's just a question of observing these cultural nuances and these cultural nuances. It really makes no difference what you do in December. That, like Yisro, is favoring the quest and not the goal. Reb Chaim said, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz said, that the perfection of man lies in perceiving a sense of chiyuv, of obligation, of commitment, even of coercion in Avodas Hashem, and not a constant choice, not to be a constant bocher. It's interesting because, you know, Bechir Chofis is a cardinal principle of Yadus, one of the 13 Ikarim of the Rambam, but nonetheless, we can't constantly be choosing in the way that, I guess, the vernacular perceives it. We don't have a choice. Every morning I have to think to ourselves, should I daven today? Should I not daven today? Every time we're hungry, should I eat kosher? Should I not eat kosher? Every time a Friday evening comes along, am I going to keep Shabbos this week or not going to keep Shabbos this week? I always tell a story of a good friend of mine who's a lawyer. Shomer Shabbos, so they know that for 20 years, he leaves Friday, he's unavailable till Motzai Shabbos. So working on some big deal, I don't even know about, some big deal that has to be finished by Sunday or Monday, and they schedule a meeting for Shabbos morning. So he said to them, you know, I can't come Shabbos morning. So they said, we thought maybe just this one time you'd be allowed to. Just this one time. We don't want to be bocharim in that sense. That every week, can't be a bocher in that sense. Every week you decide, okay, this week I will, this week I'm not. In fact, I met someone just a few months ago, and they're studying, so I asked about, I asked if it was Shomer Shabbos. They said, most weeks. It's all right, the person's on a path also, you know, an upward trajectory is also something. But we don't live with the act of most weeks. We keep kosher most of the time. You know, it's a new phenomenon. It's an American phenomenon, I guess, now 70, 80 years old. To keep kosher in the home, not out of the home.
Right.
Kashrus is kashrus. When what you're saying basically, of course not true, but what you're saying basically doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter what you're doing. It's a cultural thing. So in my home, I'm a cultural Jew. Outside the home, yeah, if I find a kosher restaurant with good service, not always easy, good food, then I'll eat there. If not, I'll go somewhere else. What's the difference really? That's what Reb Chaim Shmulevitz said. We don't live with that sense of everything is going to be a choice on a constant basis. We've got a need for this effort. That's not how Jews look at the world. There's a sense of hitchayvus in the Avodas Hashem that Yisro did not accept. Couldn't accept. He had no knowledge of such a system. He may have known, certainly knew of the Das Avram, but there was no Torah yet. With a system of mitzvos, so he had no idea that could exist. So he embraced the philosophy, also that exists in the Jewish world, that I will be Shomer Mitzvos on my terms. I'll choose Mitzvos when they're convenient, when they're satisfying, when I'm convinced, if I think it's a good thing, and if not, I'll hold off on that for a while, until I am able to convince myself that it's a responsible, reasonable way to proceed. That was why Yisro made such a request, strange as it sounds. He wanted his son, his grandson to be a komel avodas elilim, so he should see exactly what the world has to offer. Now, by the way, it's not a it's not a low level necessarily. I don't want to paint Yisro as a cartoon character. It's not a low level, because Yisro came to the truth, and in fact, many spiritual seekers, and we have in our midst, spiritual seekers reach the highest levels. The many spiritual seekers who are looking for truth, all right? Halavai they should find it, and when they find it, it's the most rewarding experience in their lives. Some never find it, and they just, I don't only mean Jews necessarily, or Gerim necessarily. That many people outside our world also looking for spiritual truth. Some of them become B'nai Noach even. You know, the numbers in the upper tens of thousands today. B'nai Noach, people believe the truth of Torah, but for them, as non-Jews, non-Christians, non-idolaters, non-any religion, the religion is the Torah, and they're Noachites, and there are such places in America. It's a movement that exists in the South that's really on the map. They're also spiritual seekers, so that's a positive. What Yisro wanted was not to punish his grandson or to torment his grandson, but to give him the joys of experimentation, of finding the truth on your own. Now, I want to be careful what I say, because we have such a thing in our world as well. You raise a child, you know, sometimes you send them off to Eretz Yisrael, they come back a little different than when you sent them there. Hopefully, a little more religious if they come back, right, if they come back. What happened? What are we telling them? We want you to find your way also. We want you to find that aspect of Yadus which gives you passion, which gives you enthusiasm, excitement. There are many, you know, Shivim Panim of Torah too. So I'm not talking about outside the world of Torah. The 70 different facets of Torah. Within those facets, a person finds that which is most fulfilling to his personality. Whatever it is, Nagdim, Hasidim, this Hasidic group, that Hasidic group, Ashkenazim, the Sfarzim, all different variations of the religious views that we have today. It's part of it. A person should not just accept the Torah as, you know, Yerusha. My parents will like this, I'll be like this, and that's it. No. She'ena Yerusha loch, the Mishnah says in Avos. It's not a Yerusha for you. It's not an inheritance, you just take it, thank you very much. It's something that you embrace, it's a morashah, it's a heritage which you embrace, and really you shape your personality in line with your knowledge of Torah and your commitment to Torah. Now, even Moshe Rabbeinu had scars from his experiences in Midian. You see the hesitation he had to accepting his mission. But more than that, Moshe Rabbeinu had accommodated himself ever so slightly to the pagan society in which he lived, so that his grandson picked up on it. And Yisro as well. Even Yisro, who's the Kohen Midyan, he never, at least at this point, he hadn't yet escaped the notion of being a Yeser, someone who wants something more, something extra, something different than what I have now. It's very interesting. Later on, what happens to Yisro? Later on in the Torah, it's Parshas Balozcha. Right when they're ready to enter the land of Israel, Moshe says to Yisro, come with us. You'll be our Einayim. Einayim, like scouts, because since Yisro knew the spiritual qualities of every society, he'd be able to help them out and facilitate their conquest of the land. And Yisro says, no. Lo elech, ki im el arzi vel molati elech. I'll go back to my land, my people. So the person say wants to magari them. And Moshe says, no, you'll come. You'll be our eyes. Whatever good happens to us, happens to you as well. They left our Hashem. The Torah doesn't say what happened to Yisro. In the end, did he go with them? Did he go back to Midian? Did he do something else? The broader question is, why do we want to leave? Now that he's found the truth, why do you want to leave? Where else can he go? Can't get something beyond the truth. The truth is the truth. That's Yisro. The person who's the seeker is always the seeker. And now if he has the truth, he's still a seeker. So maybe now he'll find the fulfillment of the new, the diverse, in preaching, in proselytizing, in talking to others about it. But Yisro, it was a personality which exists really universally, but you find it certainly Klal Yisrael, of the person who can't sit spiritually still, never comfortable with the spiritual level that he or she is on. In fact, that is something that we should all strive for. Invariably, we all descend into a certain complacency. I don't want to say mediocrity, but a certain complacency. We are who we are, we're comfortable, nothing else. You know, we are who we are, we're formed already. No, you can't look at the world like that. Each day is a new unit of Avodas Hashem. Each tefillah is a new unit of Avodas Hashem. And for a person to stagnate, then it's not just that you remain on the same level. Stagnation, by definition, means retreat, retrenchment. You're not going forward. In spiritual life, if you're not going forward, you're not standing still. You're going backwards. You think you're treading water, you can't tread water for long. Eventually the water inundates you. That's the Taurus Moshe. That's how Moshe saw the world. That's how Chazal wanted to teach us. Yisro himself could never fully accommodate himself to that notion. Could be that he stayed, and he became Leinayim. He found his fulfillment as a leader assisting Moshe. Could be also, and it could be that he died in the desert. Could be also that he disappeared into the nations of the world and did what he did. You know, the Druze, one of the most mysterious and esoteric religions around, claim Yisro as their spiritual ancestor. In fact, they revere what they call Yisro's burial ground. I think it's in either southern Lebanon or northern Israel, or I'm sorry, on the Golan. But they revere Yisro. It's a religion that, in fact, when on one of our trips 3 or 4 years ago, we went to a Druze village on the Golan. It wasn't Majdal Shamis, it was another one, I forget. And we visited with one of the Druze elders. And the question that outsiders always have to them is, you know, what do you stand for? And it's religion, only a handful of people know what it's about. They don't publicize it even to their people. They're based in the dark about it. A handful of elders convey it, whatever they believe, midor lador. All that's known about them is that they revere Yisro. So we perceive them as some type of offshoot of Islam, but be that as it may, they claim Yisro. What happened to Yisro, we don't know. The fact that there are seekers of truth in the world, from a Jewish perspective, is a good thing, not a bad thing. It's a good thing, because invariably, if a person is honest and governed by a moral code, they'll come to, if not embrace Torah, at least appreciate Torah. And therein lies, I think, the secret of the world's future, where not everyone will be Jews. But ultimately, if we do a better job of advocating on behalf of Torah, what the lifestyle of Torah is, and we represent to the world ideal concepts and implementation of morality, the world understands exactly what Torah Hashem is, and what the Malchus Hashem is as well. Yadus is defined not really by choice, but by mitzvah. You know, we understand mitzvah as commandments. The world understands mitzvah as a good deed. A good deed also, but they're not good deeds. Mitzvah is a commandment. A good deed you could do or not do. A commandment, you have to do. Yisro didn't yet accept that. And as a result, he wanted what he wanted for his grandson. Moshe Rabbeinu himself had a weakness that had to be uprooted, or that would have jeopardized the entire mission. That's why, Vayevkesheu Hashem, Vayevakesh Hamiso. You think you'll bring an uncircumcised Gershom into our midst because, what's really the difference whether a little boy is a meal or not? No, Moshe, God says. If that's what you want, then harbe shluchim lamakom. I have many agents. I'll find someone else to take your place, even after the education I invested in you. I'll go elsewhere. It's a very critical, very beautiful story because I think it uncovers through Rav Dessler and Rav Shmulevitz, two trends that exist in life. The notion how society is able to very subtly, casually, gradually whittle down our core commitments on the one hand, and the way we embrace a philosophy of laissez-faire, of live and let live, of find your own way, find your own derech, and through that you'll come to the emes. Maybe yes. Reality and the statistics show that it's not so. It's a difficult way to raise a child. So therefore our way is to inculcate in the child the way of chiyuv. A child becomes of age, he becomes a bar mitzvah, a bat mitzvah. Literally, of the commandments, because that's the age of obligation. We inculcate obligation, responsibility, then that's how the next door grows and is strengthened, that's how the truth proliferates in society, and that's the impact that the Jewish people are to have on the world, that eventually bring the world to its senses, acknowledging the Malchus Hashem. Yes. You differ with Rav Dessler. You got to take it up with him then. I don't get involved in your fights with Rav Dessler. Yeah. In what way? Right. Well, no, that's what Yalkut says. That was Moshe's hope, that Yitzhar would abandon that. Rav Dessler's style, I hear what you're saying. Rav Dessler's style, though, is really to break down into the finest elements, very, very fine, almost microscopic elements of human personality. You see, you're thinking only of a singular motivation that people have in what they do. And that's not really so. People are multifaceted. And, you know, we say, that's what we speak of mitzvahs l'shma, shalo l'shma. One can think he's doing a mitzvah l'shma, right, for its own sake, pure service of Hashem, but there's always a little taint of shalo l'shma. And that's what he's saying. He analyzes very microscopically the human personality. Yeah. That Moshe was subject to that as well. Right. 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 All right, so you're Moses' file. That's okay. Love Moshe. All right, thank you very much. Next week, Parshas Vayera.